This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit a conversation with Michael Dippy, the executive director of iDignity.
Well, something as simple as a driver's license or a state ID is not so simple. It requires a number of documents that for most of us are safely tucked away in a file or a safe deposit box. But if you're homeless, it's likely you not only don't have those documents, but it's incredibly difficult to get them. State-issued IDs open doors for jobs, housing, cashing, paychecks. You can't even get a library card in Orange County without one. We're taking on the complicated task of helping people get their hands on an ID as Michael Dippy. He started iDignity, and he joins us now. Thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
So I understand that something happened to you that helped inspire iDignity. You met a homeless man outside your church who couldn't get a check cashed. Tell me about how that came about.
Yeah, I attend a downtown Methodist church, and downtown churches do tend to have a large population of homeless people. They come to worship, but they also come with needs, which is appropriate. I took it upon myself to make sure that they felt welcome coming to my church, made sure they felt welcome to come in and worship. And during those times of hospitality, you would hear the needs. And so I became a good student of what all the opportunities are in our community for housing, for health care, for where to get food. And I came across a gentleman who... one gentleman told me that has someone that will employ him, but he's not allowed to employ him. This guy was obviously homeless. And when I asked why, he said, well, I don't have any identification. I'm having a real hard time getting it. I had not heard of that problem before. And so I figured I'd find out who does that. And let me add that to my repertoire of organizations I can refer people to. I was unsuccessful at finding an organization that was addressing that issue. And so I came back the next week to let him know, unfortunately. I'd also gone down to the DMV and said, hey, what do I do about this? And there's not a whole lot they can do. That's not their job. And so I came back to break the news to the gentleman. He wasn't there, but there was another homeless man, and he was even in worse shape than the prior one, missing part of his leg and very dirty. And very kind. We got to talking a little bit, and he reached in his back pocket and he pulled out a crumbled wad of paper and opened it up, and it was a $880 check for Social Security disability that he couldn't check because he couldn't cash because he didn't have identification. And I just thought that's obscene. That's more than my rent. And this guy's living in the bushes of downtown Orlando with this check in his back pocket, missing part of his leg. And so that's when I knew this is a significant issue. I knew that there wasn't any organization that was addressing it. And thankfully, there was other members of other congregations in downtown Orlando that were also realizing this around the same time. And so there was about 20 of us representing five downtown churches that got together. And we were determined to figure out how to solve and address this issue. And we spent about 6 months talking with government agencies, meeting with social service providers, talking with the homeless individuals and finding out what those barriers are, and devised a viable solution to the problem primarily by holding monthly events that brings all the government agencies together in one room. We surround them with attorneys and notaries and about 100, 120 volunteers, and we can assist about 250 clients in that one day, at least starting the process.
So is the biggest issue the fact that somebody who doesn't have an address, they can't get mail, so there's no way of proving, or that they don't have those extra ways of proving that they are who they say they are?
No, the top barrier is typically catch-22s. You don't have your birth certificate. You need your birth certificate, your ID. Your ID is expired. Your driver's license expired. And so you go to the health department to get your birth certificate, and they can't give it to you because your photo identification is no longer valid.
Right.
And so you're kind of stuck in this rut. Certainly address is a barrier. Financial is a barrier. These documents are often expensive, especially if there's errors in the documents that have to be corrected. So a birth certificate comes back that says baby boy because your parents never got around to quite naming you on that birth certificate.
Right.
Or has a different name because your mom really didn't like your dad. And so they were separated before you got your Social Security card. So your Social Security card has a different name than your birth certificate, which has a different name than your school records, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Is it usually a driver's license that your clients end up with, or is it a birth certificate, or is there something else that can suffice?
Well, the primary three documents that you need to participate in our society is the birth certificate, the Social Security card, and the driver's license / Florida ID card. So those are the three documents that we try to get every one of our clients. There's a lot of documents that you have to get to be eligible for those documents, but they're not primary forms of identification. They're just threshold proofs. Mm-hmm. So those are the three we try to get for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So walk me through what happens at these monthly events. You've talked about volunteers. You've got lawyers, notaries, et cetera. How do these events work from a client's perspective?
It's first come, first serve, no charge for any of the clients that we serve. They come in with any documents they have that can help establish who they are, anything with their name, their date of birth, their picture on it. And then the legal team starts working out what is the path of least resistance to obtaining what you're here to get. And a lot of that's going to be these attorneys diving into your background information, finding school records or medical records or military records or foster papers or immigration documents, even going as far as getting into census records, baptismal records, and basically building a case that you are who you say you are. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because on the other side, we're also looking at making sure you are who you say you are, making sure that someone's not getting fraudulent identification and being very cognizant of that effort as well.
Has that happened?
Not to our knowledge. We've certainly caught a number of people that have tried, mm-hmm. But we're astute at making sure that what we're doing is accurate.
So somebody who shows up with not much documentation, there's quite a bit of work in establishing their identity.
Certainly.
So this isn't just a one-time thing. They might have to come back a couple of times?
Yeah, cases can last years to untangle extensive identification issues. On average, it's probably about 3 months, 4 months. It's a lot quicker if you're born in the state of Florida. We can work with the health department here in the state more directly. But we get birth certificates from all across the nation and even documents birth abroads and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting an ID sounds simple at first, but it's actually quite complicated. The Real ID Act was enacted in Florida in 2010. It requires state driver's licenses and ID cards meet federal standards aimed at preventing terrorism and ID theft. And it requires Floridians to present documents like birth certificates, social security cards, divorce, marriage papers. You know, how difficult do you think it would be to help people get something like a birth certificate, and how difficult have you found that actually is?
It is difficult. It needs to be difficult. And that's the problem we're looking at. You need to protect the integrity of identification. So these barriers must be hard, or else there's really no value to have identification if you can just walk in and say, hey, my name's Michael. You need to be able to prove it. But there is a subset of our society that doesn't have the skills to get over these barriers. We can't lower those barriers. We shouldn't lower those barriers. But there needs to be an organization that gets together to help them overcome these barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be extensive, especially if you throw in mental health issues, people that aren't able to communicate, people that just don't even know who they are, don't even know where they're from. Building those cases can be extremely difficult. And you can imagine them trying to navigate it on their own without assistance.
And then once they've made that initial contact, they've come to one of these events, is it sometimes hard keeping track of them as you follow these cases through to the conclusion?
It's certainly hard to keep communication channels open. We do a great job of keeping track of the documents and the status of those documents and constant communication with the government agencies that are issuing those documents. We certainly have lines of communication that are open for the clients to communicate with us through phone or visiting our offices or through email. But a lot of the clients that we serve simply do not have phones, do not have computers, often don't even have physical addresses that they can be reached at. And so we tend to need to wait on them to communicate with us, either come back to them to the event to pick up their documents or reach out to us and we'll respond back to them. And that's just with the segment of the population we're dealing with, that is another barrier.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other barriers? You mentioned the expense, you mentioned the address, you mentioned the fact that you're sometimes caught in this loop of not having one form of identification or the other, and you need both of them or at least one of them to get the ID you need.
Yeah, I think the barrier, the biggest barrier is just the time, the amount of time it takes. There's significant suffering going if you don't have identification. and for clients to have to continue that suffering is an emotional barrier for our dignity as well as the clients, because you want to relieve it instantly, but you just can't. There's just no way around it, but we need to start the process now to make that suffering as short as possible. But realizing the difficulty that they're in and that they're going to have to remain in that for some set period of time, that's an emotional barrier that we have to deal with often.
Michael Dippy, what's the longest it's taken you to get a client an identification?
Probably about 2.5 years. The longer cases tend to be those that are naturalized citizens, have lost the sheet of paper that shows that they are now citizens of the United States. And I understand the difficulty of that. It does have to go through Homeland Security, and there does need to be protections there. But it does resonate with me that, and in some ways, these individuals are more U.S. citizens than I am. Mm-hmm. They've had to kind of denounce their home country. They've taken a test that I'm pretty sure I can't pass, and they lost a little sheet of paper that says so. And now it's going to take 6 months, maybe a year, even on our best efforts to get it. And that's just one of the pieces of paper that are going to need to get their ID renewed.
So, I mean, when you started out down this road, did you understand how complex it was going to be?
No idea. And not sure I would have gotten involved, honestly, if I had. I think God knew that. Kind of the, how do you get a frog into boiling water? You just turn up the temperature a little bit. And honestly, it wasn't as difficult when we started. Before the Real ID Act was implemented in 2010, it was still difficult, but that greatly increased the threshold of proof necessary.
Now, you've dealt with a lot of state agencies along the way, helping these folks get IDs. Are you seeing some of those agencies kind of recognize that there are challenges for some people, especially the homeless, and taking steps to remove some of the barriers that might not be so necessary for them?
In a sense, and once again, my role is not to reduce those barriers, it's to get people over them. The proof of residence was, when we first enacted the Real ID Act, was a hard one, especially for those living in bushes and in the woods. We'd actually have to identify on the Orange County property appraisers which piece of wood, what is that parcel, what's the address of that parcel. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and thankfully the government realized that what the address is. It's not a proof of identity as much as a proof of where can I find you if I need to find you. Mm-hmm. And so that's loosened up some to where it can be where you receive mail. Is it your aunt, your uncle? Is it your case manager? Or even you can now get indigent homeless printed on your license that you just have no place.
Mm-hmm. Now, the homeless situation in Central Florida has been more in the public spotlight in the last couple of years. But when you started out with iDignity, was that the case?
No. In a simple matter, it was homelessness. It's a tough thing to wrap your head around. I am very encouraged by our community and how we have rallied around the issue. The housing first, as well as all the other methods of addressing it. It is an extremely difficult process, as is poverty that is, a part of it. It has so many far-reaching tentacles. It can be overwhelming and intimidating. And I think initially that was part of the resistance of it. It's just too big of a beast.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we address it? I think the community is seeing that you just kind of knock down little pieces of it at a time, and eventually we can. We'll always have poverty. We'll always have some semblance of homelessness, but we can certainly reduce the suffering, and that's kind of one thing that iDignity is doing. It's just one little part of it. I'm not providing the housing or the health care. I'm not providing the food, but I'm assisting those organizations that do by taking care of the identification side of the equation.
Michael Dippy, do you think there will always be a need for iDignity?
Certainly, unless something drastic happens where we no longer need identification. You always have new people being born in the community, new people moving into the community. And we're a fairly unique model nationwide. And so there'll be a need for expansion, replication into other communities as well.
Now, there is iDignity in Osceola and Seminole counties. Is this part of your organization, or are these like franchises?
They're affiliate operations, and they're running with the guidance of the Orlando operation. They certainly raise their own money. They certainly implement their own events. We try to show them how to do it, make some connections for them with the government agencies that are involved, and use our experience to answer some of the more complex questions that they come across.
Michael Dippy, this is not only the holiday season, but it's also the giving season. Now, your organization is competing for donations with other organizations. They feed and house the homeless. I'm wondering how you make an appeal when a driver's license isn't really kind of a warm, fuzzy thing.
Right. It's a foundational issue. What do you have access to without it? And that's why we have so many social services that direct their clients to iDignity for their identification needs. And God bless them for doing it. It allows them to operate more effectively and efficiently on their core missions. And once again, I'm not providing the housing or the food or job training or whatever that is. I'm just making it so these individuals are eligible for that. And so, there's a lot of worthy causes out there to give your money and your support to. Just look at what resonates with you personally. And also get involved with that organization. Come and volunteer with them. Test the waters a little bit and see exactly what they're doing and the impact they're having on the actual clients at the end of the day.
Michael Dippy, where do you want to see iDignity 5 years from now?
Certainly replicated through the large metropolitan areas in the state of Florida and starting going into other states. Exactly how we do that through, whether it's a chapter model, through its consulting model, or some type of identification app that case managers could use. We're not quite sure. We're looking at all avenues. The goal is just to relieve more suffering. This is a solvable problem, and it's not even that expensive on a per-person basis. And the beauty is, once it's done, and we have the data of the 17,000 people that we serve, 75% of those people we never see again because their problem's solved as far as identification. And so we can beat this issue into submission. We just have to throw some resources at it. And there's not too many social ills that our society can successfully address. This is one of them.
Well, Michael Dippy is the executive director of iDignity in Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in 2016. Still to come, Reflecting on a Life in Pictures, a conversation with veteran visual journalist Red Huber, who retired from the Orlando Sentinel in September. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Red Huber's career as a visual journalist for the Orlando Sentinel lasted more than four decades. Huber learned the art of photography as a teenager, converting the bathroom at his mother's home into a darkroom, and he joined the Sentinel as the paper was just beginning to print photos in color. Huber retired from the Sentinel last September. He joined Intersection to reflect on a career documenting Central Florida, and through all of it, the importance of connecting with the community and telling the stories that need to be told.
It's been a great platform for me. I started in 72 when we were shooting black and white and color film, and stayed on that visual edge. I came from the west coast of Florida, Sarasota, St. Pete area, and where I went to school, and got a job here in Orlando. And my first thought was I wanted my photos to connect to our community. That's my goal every day, is to capture something that tells a story. Whether it's a sad story or a happy story, I want to show that emotion, that human element. It just takes that one moment to tell the story. You can shoot a lot, but it's just capturing that one moment that connects with that reader, that viewer. That's what you want to do. I mean, that's what I want to do. And it's been such a great, rewarding career for me.
So do you have a lot of photos hanging up in your house? Like, is a physical print still important to you?
Yeah, I don't have a lot. I have a couple in my den. But there are some important photos that I think that I've shot that I feel very proud of, that I've captured, that I got the access to, and I made it work. It was a difficult assignment, but I made the picture work. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I might hang up as a physical print. That's a good question, because everything's digital now. Everybody looks at their photos on their phone or their iPad or computer, but you see that print hanging on a wall, it's got to mean a lot to me. Mm-hmm. But I don't have them all over the house, just a few things. One of the photos, there was a shuttle launch coming up, and I went to someone over at NASA, Bill Johnson. He was kind of a PIO lead, mm-hmm. photo lead, and I came up with an idea. And he said, I don't think anybody's asked to do that. Let me ask. And they gave me access to putting a camera on the launch pad and got a pretty cool picture out of it. But mm-hmm. I had some challenges to make it work. And that's the part that I love, is the challenge to come up with something different that moves the needle. That, to me, is the most fun part of what I do. And by investing that time, the reward goes to the viewer, to the reader. And that's what I try to do every day. And then the paper embraces that and said, oh, wow, we got something exclusive. So, you know, I believe I've gotten some really good access because I've earned that trust. And I think I want to be that trustworthy journalist.
So talking about the shuttle program, obviously that holds a pretty dear place in your heart as far as looking back on your career with the Sentinel. What are some other shots you took from that program that really stick with you?
Photographing the very first launch was, to me, just, in my career, was epic. We didn't know, you know, I had the very fortunate opportunity to photograph the Apollo program when I was still going to school. Got to come over and do Apollo 15.
Wow.
So going from the Apollo program and then going to the shuttle program, which no one knew how loud it was going to be because I built some sound sensors to do some remote photography. So there was a lot of unknowns. So I was very successful in those launches. I kept it real simple, and it worked. And I just kept on building on that. And mm-hmm. I wanted to tell their story on how you've got this man and a machine out there in this beautiful Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge. How does this man and machine, you know, coexist with nature? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, back in the 80s, that was a big deal about environment and what's going to do with, you know, the sound and all sorts of sound suppression systems they put out there. And so I wanted to do something different. And that's how I started out, thinking about the environment, how they coexist, but still documenting. That's the thing. We're there as a photojournalist to tell a story in our pictures. But we also want to inform them. We want to show things that's compelling. And there was one launch that came up, Matthew, that my mom had just passed away before this launch. It was like in November she passed away, and the launch is in December.
Which year was this?
1998. And NASA was just getting ready to put the first piece of the U.S. space station up on Endeavour, and I think it was STS-88. And it was supposed to be in the very early morning hours, and a storm came through, and it scrubbed. So NASA escorts us out, puts us in a van, and we got reservice our remote cameras. And by doing that, rainstorm would go by, and the sun came out, and a full rainbow came out. It was unusual. It was very vibrant. And sometimes when you photograph a rainbow, it doesn't transcend that same vibrance. But this was extra vibrant. And it stretched across low, not high, out to the ocean. And I saw it, and I had my camera, like I've got right here with me, that has a wide-angle lens in it. And I jumped out of the van, got on the roof, and shot this picture. It was just gorgeous because it met right there at the launch pad with the rocket being exposed. The launch was rescheduled for the next day, but they still ran that. Well, NASA grabbed it, sent it to the crew in space, and Commander Cabana's daughter, or someone in the family, the next day they woke up, it was somewhere over the rainbow.
Wow.
And that photo is very, very, very dear to my heart, because I was very uncomfortable about covering the launch, and I think because my mom passed away, and I really feel that she was looking down at me and giving me something that no one else got. And no one else had that picture. and she supported me so much. I haven't shared this story, but we had a small home over in St. Petersburg, and I embraced photography when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and I wanted to have a darkroom. There were many times in this small home that I'd be developing film, and she'd be knocking on the door of the bathroom and say, "Hey," and I said, "No, you can't come in." She'd always support me in photography. I think that's what that was all about, is that she was looking down and said, "Hey, I'm going to give you a gift. I'm okay. I'm in a good place."
So this was a one-bathroom home?
Yes.
And you were using it as your darkroom?
Yeah.
How did the photography bug bite you? Like, what got you started?
I don't know. I remember my mom shooting pictures with her brownie, mm-hmm. and she liked shooting pictures, and that's how I got started, is that she gave me a camera, and I always thought I saw some things differently. I was out with my buddies one day, and we were out fishing. I love fishing. And I saw something, and I said, "Hey, did you see that? What are you talking about, Red?" So I always thought I looked at things differently. I don't know why, but I look at things differently. Maybe that's just my perspective. But I think you can learn photography, but I think sometimes to take it to another level, you have a gift of it.
It's the eye.
It is. I know that sounds kind of corny, but I think it is the eye. But let me just tell you, I can have the creativity, but if I don't have the trust or if I don't have the access, I can't get those different photos. So there's some that I try to look for something different that everybody has access to, and that feels good when you do that. But you want to connect. You want your photos to say, "Wow, that's what you want to do," and you want to tell that story.
When you came onto the Sentinel, the photography department must have been very different, right? I imagine just the number of photographers you had,
yeah.
the approach to photography, the pride of place that photos would have in a newspaper.
Yes. When I came, actually, I was hired because I got a lot of experience using color film at the St. Petersburg Times, and it's the Tampa Bay Times now, but...
So when you started at the Sentinel, had they started printing photos in color?
They did a little bit of color, but they wanted to increase that. They wanted to know people. And it's a different, black and white and color is a different way that, colors can distract mm-hmm. in a moment. So you have to be, there's a whole bunch of different, but it was coming on to print color. And the newspaper back then was really aggressive on being on the edge. And I felt so good at being part of that. And, the staff we had a company car that had, Sentinel Star. We were called, Sentinel Star back then. Mm-hmm. And then we had a morning paper or an afternoon paper called the Evening Star. And it really cranked back then in that respect. To me, it was very exciting because I'm just getting into the business professionally. And I was a new kid on the block. I was number 17. We're 17 photographers. At that time. And then it grew to 26. And
wow.
Yeah, 26 photographers we had on staff at one time.
And how many do you have now?
Well, we have video journalists, and I think there's a total, I'm saying maybe 6 or 7 now. And I'm included in that. Things have changed of the newspaper business and just media entirely. Media has changed. But what hasn't changed is storytelling. You still have to tell that story. You still have to, as a photojournalist or as a journalist, we want to hold people accountable. Government. We want to police, fire, just people. we're that watchdog. Watchdog journalism is so important.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the photo can really punch that story up.
It can. And that's the other thing, too, is that photos sometimes bring someone into a story. You take a heck of a photograph that says a lot. That'll bring someone, "Man, I got to read the story. That's a heck of a picture." Hmm. So I think it's very important that we always embrace good storytelling, whether it be video. When the newspaper back in the day started to go multimedia, digital. CFN 13 was a new 24-hour local news thing that was hatched on our property.
We had News 13.
News 13. It was so exciting, so cool. I embraced it. back then, video, great medium video, found that in your business, sound is so important. It is in video. But, you know, I got chills right now to talk about how video or how stills can move something to another direction in the sense of positive direction.
Some of the photos of yours that really stick with me are the wildlife photos. Like, I'm thinking of the story you told about the family of owls living at the Greenwood Cemetery.
Yeah.
And then the video, I think you stuck a GoPro camera on the back of an eel.
I'm very proud of that.
I mean, that's kind of a thread through your career, right? Those wildlife photos. I think it sort of goes back to the fact that you've always been into fishing and the environment.
Right.
How do you get some of those shots?
I'm going back to another thing, trust. Access. It's knowing some people with the Avion Reconditioning Center in Apopka, Scott and Carol McCorkle, are good friends of mine. But in conversation, I always ask the question, hey, do you think we could do this? And they said, well, I don't know. And actually, this is like 4 years ago, I did that video.
Right, yeah.
And it went kind of nuts across the platforms. And I was very proud of that. But I could tell that story in a different way. And that's what I'm getting at. I always want to try to do something different. It's my challenge. But I'll back her up a little bit. One time I was looking on the internet, and I saw a thread about two men that started something. Do you know what a golden eagle is? Have you ever heard of a golden eagle? It's larger than a bald eagle.
I've heard of it. I don't think I've seen one.
They're very big, very big birds. And this golden eagle, just picture this. You're in the Swiss Alps, and you've got cameras on the back of a golden eagle flying through the Swiss Alps.
Mm-hmm.
That was magnificent. But I had thought about putting a camera on an eagle a long time ago, but the cameras weren't that small. Mm-hmm. So I took advantage of the GoPro, but I knew that that could be a possibility. But in talking to Scott McCorkle, who is a master falconer, said, you know, we have this eagle, young eagle, that fell out of a tree in Gainesville, and Fish and Wildlife gave it to us to rehab. It's really young. It's got to learn how to hunt fish. We think it can fly. And so they bought into it, and the paper bought into it. That's another thing, too, is that give me that time. I could have been a hero or a zero. But it worked out good to tell that story differently. And they were all in, like I was. And I think that the key, again, is having them on board. I could tell their story. And I've always admired the commitment that these people have from Audubon, from Avion Reconditioning Center. I can go on and all of these men and women that take care of these owls, these eagles, these hawks, and nurse them back to health and release them. And I thought this was a different way to tell that story. And it was a lot of work, a lot of hours, but that's what we do.
Red Huber, so fun talking to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Matthew, it's an honor for you to reach out to me. I feel very fortunate that you wanted to talk to this journalist. It means a lot to me.
Thanks so much, Red.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last September. Still to come, Christmas music from Momo Brown. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to listen back to a performance from Momo Brown. The duo are Maria Lynn on vocals and Ben Brown on guitar. They joined Intersection back in 2015 with a selection of holiday tunes, including You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch, and an original song called Christmas Album.
Hey, this is Christmas time. I wonder what Santa Claus gonna bring me this year. Hey, this is crazy. Christmas time, baby. Wonder what Santa Claus gonna bring me this year. Well, if he just bring my baby home, that would ease my every care. Well, Christmas is a joyous time, peace on earth, goodwill it brings. Hey, Christmas is a joyous time, peace on earth, goodwill it brings. But if it don't bring my baby home, well, tears gonna fall like shots of rain.
Momo Brown, that's Mariah Lynn on vocals and Ben Brown on guitar. You'll hear them performing at venues around Orlando, often original songs like this next one, Pour Me Another. Ben Brown's mother wrote the lyrics.
This is an original song. It's not about Christmas, but it is about
having a beer. My mom wrote the lyrics to this song, but then I rewrote them, you know. And
made it our own.
Yeah, you know. Mm-hmm.
Is your mom a musician as well, Ben?
She plays. She sings.
She's a good songwriter, too.
Yeah, she grew up here in Orlando, you know, playing guitar and singing. And
okay, so what's the name of the song?
Pour Me Another.
Well, I've been drinking about this for quite a long time. And dark out my days on whiskey and wine. Well, sometimes I'm sober, but that's when I'm dreaming. And only time tells what the future may bring. So raise up your glasses and we'll have a ball. And roll out the carpet and dance on the walls. And paint me a smile on the face of the moon. And pour me another, or I'll be leaving real soon. Well, last night contemplating the state I've been in.
Ben Brown says they got their start as a duo after meeting at Orlando Brewing, where he was playing a solo set.
I used to add a regular gig there on Mondays, and, you know, every once in a while, Mariah would, she'd always request a song for me to play, like her favorite blues song of mine. That was a was my song. It was a Lee Swimmer song. And one day, after many weeks, she was like, oh, I want to sing that song with you. And I was like, I didn't even like know. I was like, what, you sing or whatever? I'm sure she's told me before, but, you know, that's how the beers work. Yeah, and then so she joined me.
I did. I did a little rendition of that song, and then he kind of auditioned me a little bit and was like, all right, let's see what you got, and pulled out his guitar, put me on the spot, and then we've been playing together ever since.
Ben, would you play Christmas songs when you were still sort of performing solo?
No, not really. I mean, you can only play Christmas songs during, you know, December. I'm not a big one for, you know, decorating prematurely or even keeping decorations up, so. And you think that kind of goes with music too.
But you did write that Christmas song.
Oh yeah. Well, I was going to write a whole like Christmas album like of parodies or whatever to Christmas tunes or whatever, but I just thought about it and I was like, no, you know, no one's ever going to listen to this album any other time than December or, you know, Christmas time, so it's kind of a waste of time.
So that leads me on to my next question. You guys do have a song called Christmas Album. I wonder if you'd like to play that for us.
Yeah, sure. So this is a song about what I just spoke about, not writing a Christmas album. Our song. All right.
I can write you a Christmas song, but hey, would you listen to it any other day? I don't think so. I really don't think so. So I decided just to fade a chain. That was great.
Now my mind is free of all these Christmas thoughts, and I'm thinking you might like to hear a waltz. Why would anybody want to listen to a Christmas album in the month of May, June, July, August, or even January? I could say I wouldn't, and that is why I couldn't write you a Christmas song today. Now I just must go fade a-jay.
Now, is this a song that you get requests for at Christmas parties? Do you break this one out?
I don't know. We break it out for sure. Mm-hmm. Not requests so much, and not really people know about it.
It's unexpected, yeah. You know, to have an original Christmas song. So
yeah, right.
Do you play it on the off season? Like, would you play the song in summer?
You know, maybe we should.
Yeah, I mean, I'm digging it.
Yeah, maybe we will.
Mm-hmm. So, you've got a couple of Christmas songs on your playlist. Are you sort of building up to a Christmas album? Would you have enough to do a record a Christmas album if you wanted to?
We got like six right now. I mean, Christmas EP or whatever they call them.
Maybe we can give that as Christmas gifts next year.
Yeah.
What's the next song you'd like to play for us?
The next one is Christmas Boogie. It's actually sung by, I don't know, he's probably like 8 or 9.
He has a tiny little kid.
Sugar Child Robinson?
Sugar Child.
Yeah.
How did you find this song?
I was just listening to Spotify, you know, doing some blues albums, trying to look actually for Christmas music. This was like last year when we got booked for a Christmas gig, and I love blues music, so I was just kind of browsing through and happened to find this one. And it's just really fun. It's just about, you can tell a little kid, you know, he's really excited about Christmas and just all of his presents and boogie until Christmas Day. And it's just fun and upbeat, and the crowd always seems to like it, so.
We'll take it away.
Christmas comes but once a year, and Santa Claus will soon be here. I got to boogie, woogie, woogie. I want to boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm boogie till Christmas Day. Well, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. We'll take it easy, Santa, but don't skip my house. I want to boogie, woogie, woogie. I got to boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie, I'm boogie till Christmas Day. Well, I asked old Santa for a happy suit, and maybe he can leave me a gun to shoot. I want to boogie, woogie, woogie. I got to boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie, I'm boogie till Christmas Day. Hey! Lights on the Christmas tree, snowflakes falling, it's a sight to see. I want to boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie, I'm boogie till Christmas Day. A bike and a train and a baseball glove, well, presents like this, that's what I love. I want to boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie. I'm gonna boogie, woogie, woogie, and boogie till Christmas Day.
So this song was written by a child?
That's a good question. I don't know, but he definitely plays the piano on it, and he kills it.
It's really awesome.
There's this really cool video that I shared with Momo on Facebook one time where he's playing the piano, and I was like, well, wait a second, I think this is that kid that sings that Christmas boogie song.
Are you ever sort of playing some of your songs and you're thinking, well, maybe this arrangement could use some more instrumentation, or have you thought about getting some more backing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we plan on recording all of our songs with, like, full sound. You know, I can play all the instruments on the album or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Betty's very multi-talented.
So, yeah, we recorded just, like, with the guitar and the vocals and stuff. And, I mean, we recorded, like, the Grinch song, and it has a bass line to it and stuff. But it's about as far as we've gotten, mostly just guitar and vocals. So, yeah, kind of we just want to, whatever the song calls for, just kind of add it all on there, get a full sound kind of thing going on. Maybe somebody will join us one of these days and fill out all those songs. But we're kind of picky about that kind of thing.
You're listening to Momo Brown on WMFE. Momo Brown, Ben Brown on guitar and vocals, and Mariah Momo Lynn on vocals. Speaking of the Grinch song, I wonder if you'd like to play that for us.
Yeah, that sounds good. All right.
Right. You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel. Well, you're a monster, Mr. Grinch. Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole. Well, you're a vile one, Mr. Grinch. You have termites in your smile. You have all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. Grinch. Given the choice between the two of you, I'll take the seasick crocodile. Well, you're a foul one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wasty skunk. Your heart is full of unwashed socks. Your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three best words that describe you are stink, stank, and stunk. You're a rotter, Mr. Grinch. You're the king of sinful sots. Your heart's a dead tomato splotched with moldy purple spots, Mr. Grinch. Your soul's an appalling dump heap overflowing with the most disgraceful assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable. Mangled up, entangled up knots. You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous supernos. You're a crooked, jerky jockey, and you drive a crooked horse, Mr. Grinch. You're a three-decker sauerkraut and toadstool sandwich with arsenic sauce.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. You can find us on the NPR One app or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen back at our website, wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.